We present the 398th University of Chicago Roundtable, broadcast in cooperation with the University Broadcasting Council. Today, the roundtable is discussing the question, is security increasing? Looking back upon man's struggle for mastery of his environment, can we find any evidence that life is more secure today than it was in medieval times? Certainly today, there is more change of status. Does this jeopardize our feeling of security? Are we any more secure economically or politically in this swiftly changing world? Discussing is security increasing on the roundtable today are Bertrand Russell, distinguished English philosopher and author, Walter H.C. Lovis, professor of political science, and Albert Gaylord Hart, economist. All three are members of the University of Chicago faculty. Transcriptions of this and other roundtables are available in printed form. Details will be announced at the end of the program. The roundtable comes to you from the Mitchell Tower Studio on the University of Chicago campus.
With the continued menace of unemployment facing a large number of people throughout the world, and with business fluctuations continuing to harass the prospects of the businessman to make profits, with terrorism abroad in many countries, with the direct connivance of the government, and with the general continuing threat of war to all nations, there is particular reason in discussing the problem of security and to take stock at the present time as to whether there is an increase of security or a decrease of security as we enter the new year of 1939. I suppose, Hart, one might say that security is generally increasing, don't you think so?
Well, that's pretty much a question of perspective, as I see it. Most of the people I know seem to think we're less secure than we were. Apparently, they refer back to the time just before the war as they knew it or as they imagine it was, if they're youngsters.
That was the golden age of their fathers.
Or, in the case of a good many people, still of themselves. But there's a general feeling that the pre-war period was a much better time. I remember when I was in Germany 2 or 3 years ago, I discovered curious use of language. If they said in peacetime, they didn't mean outside the wartime. They meant back before the World War. The post-war period didn't count as peace. It just wasn't part of the language. Im Frieden, in peacetime, meant back before the war. Then you take our farmers. They put up a period of parity, and the parity period, to which they look back as a golden age again, is just before the war.
I take it, Hart, that in general, the period in which we had greater security, according to this popular point of view, is the period about which we know relatively little. It is the period that just precedes our memory.
I don't think I should put it quite that way. I remember the pre-war period naturally very well. And I should say that the greater security that was felt at that time was quite genuine. I don't say that there was objectively more security, because the Great War was coming, though we didn't know it. But there was, in people's feelings, a genuinely greater security, and therefore more happiness.
Well, I should suppose, Russell, that on this basis, certainly as we go back into time, there was a time when there was greater insecurity than at the present time. As wouldn't you say that, let us say, primitive man was less secure than modern man?
He certainly had less reason to feel secure, but I suspect that he was very thoughtless about the future, and that whenever he'd got a good kill and was sitting down eating his dinner, he didn't think about the future and felt completely secure.
But he was more subject, was he not, to the dangers that came to him from disease and warfare and attack and even attack from wild animals?
Oh, yes, he certainly was. He was objectively very insecure indeed. Only he was probably less given to foresight than we are, and therefore the dangers that were not actually before his eyes, he probably didn't think about.
So that from that point of view, he, though perhaps in retrospect, and judged by our present standards, we would say he was less secure from the dangers which we know about. At the same time, he may not have realized how close to that insecurity he actually was.
Well, Lovis, you know, the economists in the last few years have been getting in a lot of trouble about talking about the state of mind of primitive man. and I strongly suspect that we don't really know anything about the question how he felt. We can say, looking at his objective situation, he was exposed to a lot of risks we're not exposed to. But goodness only knows whether he had any idea of it.
They were risks of disease. Again, they were risks which were incidental to the kind of a life he lived as compared with the kind of a life that we're living.
Or a total failure of food supply. That's a risk that people have only got away from within the last 200 or 300 years, and only in the Western world at that. There have been famines in China within the last 2 or 3 years, serious ones.
Well, would you suppose, Russell, that it would be possible for us now to make a comparison between the modern man and the medieval man? Hart here apparently doesn't want us to talk about primitive man because, according to him, we don't know anything about primitive man. Do we know any more about medieval man?
Yeah, well, I think we do. And if you read medieval literature, you find those people infinitely more pessimistic than the most pessimistic men now living. The pessimism of the Middle Ages is something perfectly ghastly.
On what do you suppose that was based?
Oh, I think it was based upon pretty good grounds. There were constant wars, there were constant famines, constant plagues and diseases in which half the population perished. Life was pretty ghastly.
So that there probably has been an advance from that time on in certain fields?
Certainly, yes.
That is greater security at the present time?
Yes, in a great many ways.
Well, that is, Russell, I take it. If you're talking about health and food supply and perhaps being swept away by a flood, things of that sort, we are more secure.
I'm not sure that we're not even more secure in regard to war. I don't know. But the amount of destruction that occurred in public and private war in the Middle Ages was very great, because there were so many private wars you never hear about.
And, of course, Russell, you do have to reckon cumulative effects. That is, after a modern war, we can patch things up after a fashion and go on pretty quickly. We did have a big flu epidemic after the last war by way of byproduct, but we don't have all the cattle and horses driven off from a certain area and the people unable to make their living on that account. Things of that sort, as byproducts of war, don't exist so much in the modern world. Maybe they will with the next war.
Though I suppose it might be said, Hart, that man was somewhat more secure in medieval times, because of the fact that he lived in a more highly organized, more careful, rigidly organized society. Don't you think so?
Well, Lavis, if you say that, I think you're using the word security in rather a freakish way. It is one of these words that float around in the modern world and don't mean anything very much. It means sugar and spice and all things nice. But I do think that you mean by security not only some certainty about the future, but a reasonable certainty of living the kind of life you want to live. I don't know that you'd say that a position of a slave, for instance, who knows that he's going to be under somebody's dominance for a long time and that he will be fed and he'll live in a little hut somewhere, I don't know whether you'd call that security in the sense in which a modern man thinks security is a good thing.
What he had was certainty, but he did not have the security for the values which we today would consider to be of greater importance.
Well, what we mean by security, as I see it, is certainty of something decent.
One of the safest men in the world in the present day is a man sentenced to imprisonment for life. But you wouldn't envy him.
There's definite certainty. What is to happen to him during the period of his confinement?
Yes, he's quite sure of getting food every day.
And he's quite sure of having to do a certain job.
Yes.
And, of course, for some people, that does mean security. Maybe that's the kind of life they want. You find people going to jail voluntarily because the other kind of life that's open to them is less secure. Most people, we wouldn't call that a good thing. And if security means anything to the ordinary man in this world, it's a good thing.
Well, now, probably you have got a good deal more security in certain respects today than you did in medieval times. Don't you think, Russell, that the outstanding sign of insecurity is to be found today in our economic and our social life? That is the insecurity which is born of the tremendous interdependence of our present economic system, of all elements in the economic system, the insecurity which comes to the individual from the speed with which our industry moves, not only the interdependence, but the specialization of tasks which individuals perform. That is, isn't this a different kind of insecurity which we have today?
Well, I think insofar as that is a matter internally for each nation, It's a matter which can be dealt with by legislation, and which, up to a point certainly in Great Britain, has been dealt with by legislation. The fear of unemployment, for instance, is not what it used to be, because a man won't starve even if he is unemployed. I think that the really serious increase of insecurity in our day is due to fear of war.
Yes, the fear of war. Now, but on this question of unemployment as a cause of insecurity, isn't there something else that comes out of our present economic system? Namely, the lack, let us say, of, well, can we call it psychic satisfaction from the job, which an individual does. Isn't there a greater personal insecurity deriving from, let us say, working on a belt in a factory, as distinct from finishing the complete product for the customer whom you know?
Yes, I suppose there may be, though I shouldn't have called that security exactly. Because if you have any kind of an artistic element in your work, you can be less sure of achieving it than if you haven't.
Well, it seems to me that both of you are waving the question somewhat of the kind of life people want to live. That is, really what you say, Lavis, does point toward that somewhat, but I don't think it goes the whole way. On the one hand, each one of these particular occupations may be somewhat monotonous. On the other hand, remember, a little while back, the only occupation open to most people was farming. And certainly, if you look at the way people rush to town, a lot of people hate farming. We do give them a choice of jobs, and we give them the possibility of moving from job to job. There's a good deal of security in that, of being able to find the kind of thing you like.
That is, you may consider the job which a person is doing as a more secure job in the sense that it is, again, more certain. That his income is somewhat more certain and more regular, at a minimum, we'll say. But at the same time, he may not feel satisfied with the job which he has. Now, don't you have a large number of people moving to the city in order to get jobs in factories because apparently they're going to be able to enjoy the benefits of urban civilization? But when they get here, they find themselves extremely insecure because of the very nature of the urban life.
Well, you might say our insecurity now results in large part from our wanting things that is just not in the nature of the system to give anybody. What we want is a something which we can't have except at the expense of somebody else not having it. Insofar as our standards of success mean getting ahead of somebody, and I think that's true of a lot of us, we're bound to be unsatisfied. Now, perhaps we can't get ahead on the farm, so we go to town, and we find we can't get ahead of anybody in town, and we are just essentially disappointed. Everybody can't... If everybody's ambition is to win a foot race, and the foot race has to have at least 20 people in it, 19 people out of 20 are going to find that the world doesn't hold the kind of life they want. And in that sense, with that sort of ambition, security to live the kind of life you want is something you can't have.
Well, you can't possibly get security in the world unless people are so educated that their desires will be non-competitive. If you desire to be rich, we could conceivably all be rich, but if you desire to be richer than your neighbor, that's impossible for everybody.
Yes, it's impossible for everybody. But the sort of security I was thinking of here, Russell, was, or rather the sort of insecurity I was thinking of, was the sort that seems to be the product of the industrial world in which we're living. There appears to be an amazing increase, for example, in the insanity rate. Personal insecurity, isn't insanity, after all, a manifestation of this personal insecurity, in the sense that the individual is unable to adjust himself to his new environment.
Yes, of course, the environment changes so fast nowadays, and I think that's the thing which will have to come to an end. If the environment is going to go on changing faster and faster, there will come a point where we cannot adjust ourselves to the changing environment, and where we shall all go mad. And in fact, that point is being reached rapidly, I think.
Yes, and certainly if you compare that condition with the condition you had in medieval times, life is much less secure.
Instead of encouraging inventors, we shall have to punish them. The moment will come when every inventor will have to be put to death.
Unless we can find some social controls which will take care of, which will make up for the problems which are created by the inventor.
Well, I think you said the other day at lunch, Russell, that While there are types of insanity that go with rapid change, there are also types of insanity that come out of monotony. And the world used to be full of them. A good many of them seem to be rather disappearing.
Yes, of course you want more an adjustment if you want in all these things. Neither too much monotony nor too much change. In the Middle Ages, whole populations would go mad out of monotony.
As this is all approaching the problem of insecurity from the point of view of certainty, isn't it? That is to say, you want to have security, that is, you want to have certainty that the things which you have become accustomed to today will still be here tomorrow. That is, you will understand the world in which you're going to live tomorrow. And in the sort of a civilization in which we're living, things are changing so rapidly that the solution to these signposts. Now, that is perhaps in a general sense the same sort of thing that the ordinary businessman faces today, Hart. Or he seems to face it periodically. I gather that one of the most insecure periods for the businessman is the period in which Congress is in session, or the state legislature, because it may do things.
Well, if you would read the financial pages, you'd certainly get that impression. I think you can say the businessman today feels that he's living in a world that he doesn't quite fit in. And certainly that's part of what you mean by insecurity. That's partly due to the fact that his ideas about society, I think, change rather by jumps. The English businessman seems to have adjusted himself to exactly the sort of change in social institution which the American businessman now finds makes the world strange. England has been enjoying a very handsome boom in the last few years under just the same sort of social controls that the American businessman seems to feel spell the end of the kind of world he knows. I do think that there's a likelihood that in that respect, the pace of change will slow down after a while, that the United States, at least, has a reasonable chance of arriving at a system where the key people do feel at home. Well, We're not there now.
I didn't mean, Hart, in terms of, let us say, New Deal legislation, which is going to hurt somebody who doesn't believe in the New Deal. What I meant, rather, was that whenever Congress is in session, I think this has always been the case. There is always the possibility that it might do something that's going to affect the kind of a business you want to carry on either today or tomorrow. In the same way that you get a period of great uncertainty when there is a possibility that you may go to war or you may not go to war. For the ordinary individual, it's much nicer to know, yes, we are going to war, or no, we're not going to war, than to have the possibility that we may do the one or the other. I mean, certainty and uncertainty, security, insecurity, in that sense.
Well, that sort of doubt, as a matter of fact, is one of the most convincing explanations you get for last year's business recession, that we had the sort of a war crisis where the businessman couldn't prepare for either war or peace, and he was left more or less at a dead center.
And it's the same sort of thing that you have whenever you have an election. But now, Russell, I judge from some things we've said before that these little things, these minor fluctuations in our sense of security and insecurity in this country, are relatively unimportant from the point of view of the English. There's a much greater, a long-range picture of insecurity that you're worried about.
They sound so to me, yes. I mean, the sort of things that you say worry your businessmen are the sort of worries which we would give our eyes to be able to feel because they're so small. We all are, I mean, we don't know, any of us, whether we should be alive 6 months hence. We don't know what sort of destruction is going to overtake Europe. We don't know whether any of the institutions, political or social, that we've grown up in are going to last. The whole world is completely in the melting pot. That is now the case in Europe and in Asia. It will be the case in the United States, too, as soon as bombing aeroplanes can easily cross the Atlantic.
As in a world in which bombing aeroplanes are instruments of international blackmail, it's practically impossible to talk about any sort of future with certainty.
Yes, until that menace has been dealt with, until the menace of national armaments used for purposes of blackmail has been dealt with, mankind have got to have an increasing sense of insecurity.
Now, isn't that a nice illustration, again, of the sort of problem that we face in a world which has found all sorts of mechanistic answers for tasks which were to be performed, but which has not yet found the social answers. That is, as you create the problems of the factory, the problems of the urban community, it's necessary to get social institutions, institutions which men will operate in order to increase security of each man. Now, so far as this menace of war is concerned, there we come to the need of creating international political or international social institutions which will guarantee the security of all as against the particular security of one nation.
Yes. The whole point of modern developments, scientific developments in every direction, is that the acts of one man or of one group have more effect than they used to have upon other men or other groups, and therefore require more regulation. That is true in the life of the community internally, and it is becoming increasingly true in the relations of communities.
But the kind of regulation we get, Russell, seems to me often to be rather irrelevant to the issue. That is, because we have this problem of the other fellow's bombing plane, we tend to get regimentation within the country, which makes us more dangerous to the other country rather than make them more dangerous to us. It's interesting to notice that preparation runs to building bombing planes yourself rather than building up your anti-aircraft armament.
Well, all you're arguing, though, Hart, there, is that if Germany, let us say today, wants to increase her own security by arming to the teeth, that the answer is not to be found in arming to the teeth ourselves, but in somehow inveigling Germany into cutting down her armaments.
Well, I don't think either the one or the other. It seems to me the only thing that can possibly deal with the menace is the establishment of some supranational power which is able to control the ambitions of individual nations.
Yes, but that's precisely the sort of adjustment we don't make. As we're getting more scared, we're getting more and more leery of the international devices that exist, and more inclined, as Eliot put it last week, to destroy freedom with our own hands in our country, lest somebody else may come in from outside and do it, and to set up institutions which make the other fellow more scared. We tend to get frightened and to concentrate more and more on the kind of thing which makes the other fellow frightened at great personal inconvenience to ourselves.
That is so, but one supposes that after a sufficient experience of disaster, I mean, we perhaps learn something.
Yes, and isn't it also true, Russell, that the efforts to establish international government are comparatively recent, that is at least measured in terms of the history of the development of the world as the market within which we operate. This whole idea of economic interdependence is a relatively new thing, I mean, relatively in terms of time. And we've attempted to create international institutions to set up social international controls in order to provide security for each person only within comparatively recent times. It is a matter of 20 or 30 years at the most. And as you say, it is simply to be hoped that we will learn where our security lies and not go down in the process.
I think it's even to be expected. I have great faith in the stability of the United States. I think if that country did not exist, I should take a very much more pessimistic view of the future.
You mean that Europe is gone anyway?
I think so.
But do you think it's gone beyond the point where even the United States could do something?
No, I think after the next war, they'll be able to build us up again. I don't think they'll be able to prevent a disaster, but they'll be able to repair some of the ravages after they've happened.
Well, but that does call, I think, for a certain realism in looking at things. The thing that gets me down as economist about the internationalism of the 20s was the tendency to believe that everybody's interests could be reconciled without anybody making any sacrifices. You get this picture of objective social forces, which we'll control somehow, without the idea that a social force is somebody trying to do something. And you have this pretty picture from the League of Nations people of a degree of common interest, which I think doesn't exist. If we're going to arrive at any sort of workable international system, we'll have to start with the recognition that it's just impossible that everybody should get what he wants to the full extent. That everybody, there's going to have to be a good deal of give as well as some take about our international settlements. And the United States in particular seems to me to have shown a good deal of lack of grasp of that. If you look at our policy at the 1933 Economic Conference, our policy was to go there and see whether other people would make concessions that pleased us without the slightest willingness to make concessions that would please them.
Well, there's even a more amazing illustration than that, Hart, in the opposition which is developing at the present time again in the country to our reciprocal trade program. Everyone, I think, who has examined the question realizes that the only prospect for increasing the security of all, we call it peace on the international level, is by increasing trade, increasing prosperity, and developing correspondingly international political institutions. And yet, there are plenty of people who subscribe to the idea that we shall have international peace and international security, but who are unprepared to make the particular sacrifice that is involved for their own particular industry.
While you're at it, mind you, that's a question of cooperation within the country rather than international cooperation. That is, in a realistic view, the American public as a whole would gain from unilateral trade concessions by the United States. We call them concessions, but they'd be largely concessions by certain groups within the country to other groups within the country, with incidental benefits to foreigners. But we don't think of things that way. Everybody tries to hang on to everything he's got and to think of things to give the other fellow which don't matter to him.
Exactly. Now, doesn't this development, Russell, come down to this, that as each person is trying to build up his own certainty and build up his own security, he can do this by individual means. He can build up his own power and do whatever is possible for his own self and let the devil take the hindmost. Or it is possible to do it through associations, for example, by setting up insurance companies in order to provide protection. And sometimes this is provided by private organizations, fraternal organizations. Or it may conceivably be done by public authority. It may be done by governmental organization. And we've done pretty well in providing this governmental organization on a national basis. But the place we've completely broken down so far is on this international horizon.
Yes, and I don't see much hope of getting anything done there until the strong nations have a sense of mutual justice and a willingness to forego some part of complete sovereignty for the sake of international cooperation and peace. I think that is still some way off.
And when you're talking about strong nations, you're talking about the nations in which there are strong individuals, strong men who are able to influence the policy of the strong nations.
Well, I should expect them to turn up if the nation was strong. I think the strength of the nation is not mainly dependent on the strength of individual men.
No, but the policy of a strong nation is dependent upon what the strong men within the nation are prepared to do.
Well, you can work it both ways, Lavis. That is, if you're scared, you're not sane. If you're strong enough so that you don't have to be too scared, it's possible that you may be able to be somewhat reasonable. If there is any hope in this world, it's in people being willing to act reasonably.
But it is possible to build up your strength to the point at which you jeopardize your own security. And I should suppose that what we have seen throughout this discussion here is that man is continually seeking to find for himself greater security, greater assurance, and greater certainty. And this he has tried to get through all sorts of means. He's tried to get it individually through control of the elements. He's tried to get it collectively through control of the elements. But he's also wanted to preserve for himself a certain amount of opportunity for adventure, for the insecure thing. And the problems of insecurity are largely the products of the actions of individual men and what men particularly do. And the only way in which security for all of us can be secured is through compromises of each of us and also on part of every one of us. This is the same, essentially, as the problem of freedom, in which all people want more, but which few can enjoy without the restrictions upon all.
You have been listening to a discussion of Security Increasing by the University of Chicago Roundtable. Participating were Bertrand Russell, visiting professor of philosophy, Walter H.C. Lavis, professor of political science, and Albert Gaylord Hart, economist. All three are members of the University of Chicago faculty. Would you like to have a printed copy of this discussion? A 6-month subscription will bring you the next 26 discussions for $1. Any 5 transcripts are 25 cents and single copies are 10 cents each. Address, the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago, Illinois. Next Sunday, the Roundtable will discuss How Shall We Solve the Housing Problem? This has been an NBC educational feature, and this is the National Broadcasting Company.